Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
We are here talking about your book, No Book But the World. And when I first heard the title, it struck my ear as awkward, No Book But the World. And then I opened up the book, and there's a Rousseau quote, and it all makes sense. Let there be no book but the world. Was that quote the starting point for your book?
No, I found the quote partway through. I didn't even know Rousseau would enter into the book until I'd written a certain way into it. The starting point for the book was this question, what happens when there's someone who's difficult for the world to understand and difficult for the world to love? Mm-hmm. What hope is there for that person, and how do we reach out to that person when we're not really drawn to mm-hmm. that person?
Could you introduce the story of No Book But the World?
Yes, so this individual that I have been obliquely referring to is Fred, and he's the brother of the narrator, or the person who narrates part of the book. Ava, Fred's sister, is close to Fred, but has also found him to be a burdensome little brother. Growing up together, they spent lots and lots of time together. They grew up in a non-traditional family, and Freddy, as he was known as a little boy, was different from other people in ways that were never named because their parents didn't want to have him evaluated or diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. And labeled, right. And therefore boxed.
Exactly.
And so they grow up. Their father, Neil, is an educator of a type.
Yes.
He has a theory of education that is sort of non-education, non-school. I think his wife says, or June, their mother says, you know, that they provide them with freedom and the freedom to explore.
Yes.
And this idea, like Rousseau, saying that, you know, they shouldn't be learning in books and in schools. They should have no book but the world.
Yes.
In which to learn.
You got it. So that's yeah. That's sort of full circle back to the title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your characters, you've written a book that for me is, I sort of catch myself because I realize you've written a book so completely that I think, oh, well, it's true. You know, and I just assume you're the expert on all of this. You know? However, you are the expert on your characters, I think, because I think you know them incredibly well. How do you find them? Who starts?
So, I mean, I think the last thing you said is interesting in the context of this novel in particular, because that's a question that Ava wrestles with, is how fully can we know one another?
Mm-hmm.
So certainly as the creator of these characters, you know, I come to them with a certain amount of humility. Yes, they are my creations, but if my job is to understand them in as complex detail as they contain, you know, I certainly didn't have that at the beginning of the project, and I don't claim to know them through and through mm-hmm. now. You know, for me, the process of writing the book is largely the process of sort of humbly coming to know them a little bit more clearly and a little bit more clearly.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why they seem like real people, mm-hmm. because I think they are like real people. You know what I mean?
Well,
you know, that same way. And so they grow up, they have quite an unusual upbringing. And one of the things I just thought was really funny is that their father is, you know, this used to be a school of sorts where they live. It's sort of an isolated sort of upstate New York community, which I suspect is near Deposit, New York, where I went to camp.
Oh.
Where I was camp counselor. I know these people. And one of the things is that he's quite well known, and I just thought it's very funny the way, and it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, alternative or quasi hippie or, you know, or whatever your perception of him is. But your children perceive you incredibly differently and don't give you the deference that you think you deserve.
That's true. It's funny. I was just reading an interview with Barack Obama, and he was talking about how, you know, at the end of the day, he comes home and Michelle and the girls are teasing him and making fun of him. Never mind that he's the president.
You're not the president in here. You know, you're just another guy showing up in this house. Yeah, it's very funny.
So, and Neil is actually... He's sort of modeled on and a kind of homage to A.S. Neil, who was the founder of Summerhill here in England, the famous free school. Yeah, so he is, you know, there is that sort of glow of a real sort of legendary educator lurking behind his fictional character.
Yeah. And he didn't have children till quite, you know, in this book, he didn't have children till quite late. And I thought the Rousseau connection was interesting, and I think it's so funny that it didn't come to you. Like, this story was sort of evolved already before it came, because, you know, he wrote this whole treatise on education and children and had given all of his 5 children up for adoption.
Yes, yes. So strange. I never studied Rousseau in college or anything like that, and it was a friend one time. We were having this conversation, and a friend told me about Rousseau, and the way I remember being sort of introduced to his ideas on education, which now that I've read Emile, A Treatise on Education, I realize, you know, it's not actually in the book, but the friend described his theories to me by saying, well, Rousseau believed you shouldn't give a kid an apple and say, this is a piece of fruit, it's called an apple. You should just give a kid an apple and let the kid feel it and smell it and taste it and, you know, experience the apple and come to know the apple through experience. And I thought that was great, you know, and so years and years later, I decided I have to go actually read his book. So Rousseau sort of got braided into the novel. It was so natural that he would be Neil's, you know, sort of ideological hero.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
One of the things that struck me as very poignant about the book, because it is, you know, there's a lot of sorrow in this story, because, as you say, Freddie, or when he grows up, Fred, is difficult to reach, difficult to read, and ultimately difficult to know and to love. And he's difficult even for Ava to know and to love. And then what happens, you know, when you're no longer surrounded by family, who's at least nominally their job, you know, theoretically anyway, and the way it's supposed to work, is no longer there. And what care? But there was also... There was a hope, a humor, a joy that's sort of a constant, I don't know if it's a thread that Ava wants to find, or that she, you know, it's a sort of a seam that she tries to find through things.
That I'm so glad that you felt that. I think she starts out, I mean, I think she even declares herself to be a fairly solemn person at the beginning of the book, especially in relationship to her best friend from childhood, who she perceives as more fun-loving and having a sense of humor and a sense of the absurd. And Ava has always felt herself to be, you know, just more serious-minded, partly perhaps because of this sense of responsibility toward Freddie that she's always felt. But I do think, you know, I felt a softening, a loosening within Ava as the story progresses. And so I'm very glad that seeps through.
Yeah, I think as she gets older, so Lucy, the story is they grow up in this sort of sheltered and unsheltered way, You know, sort of nothing's hidden from them, and nothing's, you know, they're not sheltered in any way of what comes to them, but not that much, you know, outside of outside of, you know, the woods and their own games, you know, comes to them. And when she does eventually, when Ava, they both eventually go to primary school, and that starts to, so the outside world starts to press in on them. And for Ava, it seems like it presses on her from the inside almost, as opposed to something coming outside, because immediately, you know, your differences show. And hers aren't as stark as her brother's, but there are differences in her. And later on in life, I mean, I think she incorporates that, but I think something comes around to her, because being thrown together with her brother, like any sibling. I mean, I remember, you know, my mother used to call me Little Me Too, and I'd follow my sister around. You know, I was like, you know, like a car boat, you know, like a barnacle on her, you know what I mean? And you want to shake that off. Any older sibling wants to shake off a younger sibling, period. And then you have these added complications later in life. But it's sort of a reaching back out. And
yeah, I think, I mean, you're right that in Ava's case, that tension is doubled. Because as you point out, you know, any sibling might well feel a desire to move beyond the family and distance herself from, in this case, her little brother. But in Ava's case, because her parents have made such a sort of overt choice to distance themselves from the world, and, you know, there's something almost, you know, Amish about the divide that her parents erect mm-hmm. between their way of living and, you know, typical mm-hmm. culture around them. So when Ava makes that choice to separate, as all healthy children really do as part mm-hmm. of growing up, it's this doubled separation, and her father at least experiences it as a rejection of all that he believes in.
Yeah. And all that they've tried to do, this idyllic
yes.
existence.
And that's, mm. I mean, that's the word. You know, that's been mm. the sort of family myth, that Ava and Freddie are growing up, you know, that they're sort of luckier than most children because they're given this idyllic experience. And, mm. of course, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and to reject that is to reject him and their ideals. And every family has these myths. You know, these sort of creation myths, you know, just like any society, you know, and especially the more insular the family, I think the stronger the creation myth.
Yeah. And so in this case, the separation between this family and its myths and the rest of the world is maybe more pronounced.
Mm. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. Yeah. Every family has its version
yeah.
of that.
Yeah. And there comes to a point in the book. Okay, so what we do know from the outside jacket, because I don't want to ruin things. They grow up. Ava and her husband have moved back to where they grew up because her husband is her best friend's brother, as it turns out, all these years later. So someone who sort of gets it.
Right.
But her brother has, you know, moved out to Cape Cod. He's sort of nominally being looked after. But it turns out he hasn't been, and where he's been living, a young boy is lost and then found dead. And Fred is implicated, presumed guilty, presumed involved, presumed guilty, etc., and taken into custody, which is where we meet them, and then we go back in the past and come toward this point. And it brings up for Ava, you know, she has to relive all this and rethink all this and re-experience it, and then decides really quite beautifully in a way to change it, to re-examine her own thoughts about it and examine how everyone must have been feeling, like to look at it freshly and with maybe a little bit more compassion and a little bit love. And she imagines, this is obviously my suppositions upon reading it, this is my experience as a reader. She imagines everyone's story that was touched by these experiences and this storyline. But the one thing she doesn't reimagine, and I really wanted to ask you about this, is Fred's fate at the end. She doesn't imagine a different ending for him. Why was that?
I listening to you, I'm thinking about how, to an extent, all of us who, you know, as adults want to make sense of how we were formed and where we came from, I think do a certain amount of this psychic work where we reflect back on memories, and with the privilege of hindsight perspective and maturity, we make meaning of those memories that we weren't able to access at the time we lived them. So I think this is the energy that Ava brings in her effort to try to figure out what exactly has happened. You know, Fred's in jail and won't really communicate much with anyone. She feels a certain amount of urgency around trying to understand and then explain the story of what happened to everyone else. So for her, there's, you know, a dire need to make use of her memories and her you know, reflective ability to sort of synthesize meaning around those memories in order to address, you know, a very urgent need in the present. I think because as you so gracefully, you know, and without revealing too much, put it, if Fred's fate is something that happens, you know, it unfolds in real time in the book. And so in a sense, you know, it comes to Ava as a shock, and she's not engaged in trying to, you know, imaginatively alter the present. She's really just trying to use her imagination as a tool to make sense of the past.
Yes. That's the answer.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I also wanted to, I haven't, it's not published here. I don't know.
Right.
Fantastic essay. Essay, book, what is
it?
What is it?
Yeah. It was a tiny essay that grew into a very short book.
But it's great because everyone, there is some circumstances, and sometimes there are a lot, but there is some circumstance when we're too chicken to say, I don't know, to admit that we don't know something. And how important it is to do that.
Yeah, and I have found it so, you know, speaking of liberty, which is an important theme in No Book But the World, I have found it so liberating and also really delightfully humorous to have the conversations that have been generated by that book. Because as you say, I haven't met a single person who can't relate to having at one time or another felt pressured to pretend they know something that they don't.
And it's funny because we do, there is a judgment. I think you, in the book, you make a connection between authority and knowledge, you know, with doctors, with teachers. And I just thought the parallels with No Book But the World were great because, you know, in a sense, trying to put some of those really, I thought, you know, some of the ideas of non-school learning and allowing children to, you know, to learn things is, you know, is a much better model.
Right.
But, you know, you don't know that. I mean, it's so many times we are shut down for not knowing something or use knowledge as a weapon as opposed to...
Right, a weapon to shame someone. And that is, I mean, you know, I hope I don't give short shrift to Neil's ideas in the novel, because as much as I take a hard look at the detriments in this, you know, in his philosophy. There are some really wonderful aspects of it, and one is Fred and Ava growing up with these parents never were shamed for not being able to produce a knowledge pearl or, you know, seeming uncertain. Their parents would delight in their curiosity and questioning and exploration.
There's, in that family, there's a family anecdote about when Ava discovers nettles.
Yeah.
which is quite funny because if I remember correctly, so she gets stung by nettles and comes, you know, shrieking in pain, you know. So then they discover what nettles are, and, you know, part of what nettles are is something you can make soup out of, you know, which is kind of wonderful and kind of like, could you just find me a dock leaf?
Exactly.
You
know what I mean? I mean, I think for Ava, the memory is very loaded because her father would then, when he would be invited to, you know, do public speaking and talk about his philosophy, he would share that story as this golden example of how his approach to child rearing and education is so great. And, of course, you know, what Ava remembers is, you know, right, she wanted a little more sympathy and tending to. Yeah, not sort of, what do you think we might make with these nettles?
Yeah.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
Tell me about your writing process.
Well, it's funny. I don't know how it works in England, but in the States, you hear a lot about these retreats and these writing colonies and these, you know, sort of residencies.
Yes.
And
yes.
And they always sound amazing. And you hear stories of, you know, writers who go and they get, you know, a beautiful room or a little cabin, and they get lunch delivered to them in a basket outside their door so it won't interrupt their writing process. And it's all very sort of precious, but also completely jealousy making, right?
Yes, yes. We make it up just to make you feel bad, just so you know.
And so, you know, for years I kind of thought, like, gosh, you know, how come I've never gotten to experience that paradise island for writers? And meanwhile, you know, and I had three small children, and, you know, a solo mother, and you know, and didn't, there was no possibility of taking a week or anything like that to go away. So my process, by necessity, was sort of working whenever I could manage the time, when the kids were in, you know, daycare or school, and I wasn't doing laundry or shopping or washing the dishes. And the truth is, I think that sort of instilled in me a really useful discipline, which is that I don't... So the shorter answer to your question is I don't have a process per se other than sitting down and writing. And I, you know, now all
getting
these
the job
later,
done without all the frills.
Right. I don't, you know, I don't sort of need any special time of day or mood. I just work when I can work.
Right. How did you come to writing? Have you always written? Have you?
Yes. My mom would write stories that I would dictate to her before I could write. I think they couldn't really shut me up. I just loved to play with words and make up little rhymes and make up beginnings of stories. And as a little girl, I named my fingers, and I would sort of create.
What were their names?
They were crazy. They were like Chula, and, you know, sort of made up names. And but they, you know, they'd hear me talking, and it was clear that I was talking with various characters, and they, you know, my parents noticed I was actually making up stories about these people that I had my fingers representing. So I, you know, I think it was in me from birth, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, I think it's possible too that many of us, when we're very little, have an inclination to play with story making. So I will say too, I had my mother in particular never squashed it, and on the contrary, she treated that part of my interior life with real respect. You know, and it's sort of a funny word to you know, to think of a mother treating her, you know, 3-year-old with respect.
It shouldn't be funny, but
it shouldn't be funny.
But
I don't think she had undue respect. You know what I mean? She didn't make more of it than it was, but she didn't dismiss it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She honored it.
That's a nice way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So I got that message very young that this was legitimate to love.
Mm-hmm. Your mother sounds like a very wonderful woman. Because just from the bit at the end of I Don't Know, when you talk about your mother and her contract.
Yes.
That she told your son. She said, did I ever tell you about the contract? Could you
right.
tell us that
yeah,
story?
Because
it's
love
really
this
lovely.
Story. Yeah. So when my oldest was about 10, I think, he had a sledding accident near our house. It was snowy. We took our toboggans to the hill, and he sledded down the hill, and he sort of went off at an angle, and he went very, very fast, and he went skidding right across the road. There were no cars coming, but he smashed into the garage door of the house opposite where we were sledding. And the garage door had been left open about a foot, and so he hit the door, the toboggan went out from under him and, you know, sailed right through the garage. And my son was stopped at the point of contact with his shin, you know, and it hurt. Right, yeah, it was a big swollen mess for a while, but he was fine. But one of the adults standing there made a comment that if the garage door had been open another foot, he might have been beheaded. And my son overheard that, and, you know, scary words for a 10-year-old, and he was really haunted by that. And had trouble sleeping. And so then we went to visit my parents, my mother knew that he was having trouble. And that's when my mother said, you know, did I ever tell you my theory about the contract? And he said, no. And she said, well, the way I look at it is this. When we're born, it's sort of like a contract. We get this wonderful thing. We don't have to do anything, you know, to get this gift of being born. We get to be alive and be a person in the world. And the only thing that we have to do to complete the contract is die. And we run into trouble when we think of death as unnatural or evil or, you know, something terrible. But when I think of it, she would say, in terms of just it being the balance, you know, due on the contract, it makes the prospect of death feel very different. Sort of
it's my job.
Natural. It's, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's my job. It's the only condition for this wonderful gift of getting to be alive. And I had never heard her say that before.
That's
so
funny.
Yeah. So my son
funny.
And
you're
I were kind of sitting there wrapped. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, she had a wonderful way of looking at so many things. I find myself more and more with my own kids, again, trying to be mindful of a sense of proportion and to approach the job of being a mother with an adequate amount of humility. You know, I think a big part of the job of being a mother is knowing how and when to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And similarly, as a writer, you know, anytime I try to steer things too much, I make missteps. Mm. And it's often when I'm well enough into a story that I trust the process enough to get out of the way that my understanding of the story blossoms.
Yeah. Wonderful. Leah, thank you so much. You have been so generous in following my meandering around.
No, thank you, Donna. This is really fun. I like meandering.
Right. Meandering is good.
Yes.
Meandering is good. Oh, thank you so much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling? Thank you.
I might be a part of this ripple on water from a lonesome trip, a fallen tree that witnessed me, him alone, him and me. And that life itself could not aspire to have someone be so admired. I threw creation to my kin with a silence broken by a whispered wind. All of this can be broken, all of this can be broken. Hold your devil by his throat and spin him to the ground. And root to root and tip to tip, I look at him, my country chip, let it up by all his fears, but someone brought you close to tears. Many trains and many miles brought you to me on this sunny isle, and one of which you wish to speak, have you come here to rescue me? All of this can be broken, all of this can be broken. Hold your devil by his spoke and spin him to the ground. Your life lives but lies no more, and where she lay a flower grows. And the arms that fed, and the babes that wed, and the backs that bled, keeping her in tow. But I am your keeper, and I hold your face away from